This is Climate Justice, Y'all, a podcast dedicated to lifting up and centering the climate and environmental justice movement in the South. Despite the South being the most biodiverse, diverse, and one of the largest economic engines in the world, we're underfunded and often barred from the decision-making table. Because of that, we decide to pull up a chair and amplify the stories of communities in the South that are hit the hardest by the climate crisis. We're using good old-fashioned storytelling to shine a spotlight on these Southern leaders from all walks of life, putting in their blood, their sweat, and their tears to transform this region. The usage of y'all in the title's on purpose. We are honoring our Southern heritage of creativity, resilience, and ingenuity.
I'm your co-host, Marisha Malcolm, and I am joined by the fabulous host, Abigail Franks. In the South, we are no stranger to the Civil Rights Movement, the effects of the Jim Crow era, and environmental injustice. The whole country is affected by the issues and social movements, but the South, we're especially pretty loud about it. Because of that, we decided to bring in an expert and survivor of the intersection of environmental justice and civil rights, Ms. Kathy Eagling.
Climate justice, y'all. It's real, it's here, and it's about time we listen to folks like Katherine Eglund, who's worked alongside leaders such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela, and has fought for justice in Gulf Coast, Mississippi for decades.
So, Ms. Kathy, we just want you to start off by introducing yourself and your organization.
Hi. Yes, I'm Kathy Eglund, or Katherine Eglund. I actually do work, frontline work on behalf of several organizations. One is a local regional organization that I co-founded. It's a Gulf regional-based organization, simply because there are so many environmental and climate justice issues facing the Gulf region, which is where I live, that I felt that I needed this organization to keep me grounded in the grassroots work that I do. Another organization that I do work on behalf is the NAACP, where I serve as Environmental and Climate Justice Chairman for the National Board of Directors. I also work with the National Council of Negro Women.
Dang, so you're basically all over the place, it seems. It seems like you do local, like regional and national work?
Absolutely. I always say that I have a local to global connection. That's why I say ECHO keeps me grounded in my Gulf regional base work, which is so very important because we're a sacrifice zone. But we also have this local to global reach a lot of, with the NAACP, and a lot of the work that I do with the NAACP is national and international.
That's really, really cool. So, like, I know this may be like a loaded question since, I mean, you've been in this fight since the 60s. I see listeners, you can't see this, but her Zoom window has a picture of her and I think Nelson Mandela.
That is absolutely correct.
That is so cool. Yeah, but so like you've been in this for a while, but like what got you started in this fight? I kind of did some stalking online just because I've heard so many great things about you. And I saw that you've survived some of the worst climate and environmental justice disasters our country has seen, like BP oil spill and Hurricane Katrina. Did that affect why you got into this fight, or was that after you've been in the fight for a while and was it just proving your point?
Absolutely. Let me say that to be born in Mississippi, you're basically born in the civil rights movement. And I was born in Mississippi during segregation. So I was pretty much born in the struggle. I can remember being a member of the youth NAACP from as young as 10 years old. I held office in the youth NAACP, and growing up, I belong to two organizations, the Youth NAACP and the Catholic Youth Organization. And we did a lot of work at very, very young age in civil rights and social justice. So it was a part of my life. It was a part of my being. That work continued. I knew people, like I had the opportunity as a child to meet Dr. Martin Luther King. At that time, you know, I didn't really know the importance of taking pictures. So when I got the opportunity to take one with former President Nelson Mandela and Ms. Rosa Parks. I treasure those.
Wow.
I also had the opportunity to meet people like Megar Evers. And one of the individuals that really inspired me to stay in this struggle was Mr. Vernon Damer of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, who may not be as well known or as other civil rights warrior, but I learned how to drive in the Kelly Settlement area, which is where he had a store that was firebombed. His home and the store were firebombed by the KKK, and he was killed. And I pretty much recall at a very, very young age making a conscientious decision that I knew that those people died for my freedom and died for rights that we enjoy today. And I wanted to make sure that they did not die in vain. So I continued in the struggle. The trajectory of my civil rights advocacy changed after Hurricane Katrina. Now, let me say, before Hurricane Katrina, I was always very conscious of environmental and climate justice. I won't say maybe not so much from a justice aspect, but I was very environmentally conscious. And, you know, to me, I really thought that I was really doing my job. But then I realized after Hurricane Katrina that I was more of a conversational awareness individual as it related to environmental and climate justice. I was not involved in any advocacy work to the level where I should have been. And it took Hurricane Katrina to propel me to become, to prioritize environmental and climate justice in my civil rights advocacy. And it wasn't just the devastation and the carnage that I witnessed in my own home. I suffered a 78% loss of my own home. And I felt very lucky, you know, because so many people had absolutely nothing left. They had only the foundations of their home left. But the greatest tragedy and the greatest loss for me for Hurricane Katrina was the death of two of my dearest family friends who, were lost to drowning when the rapid waters of Hurricane Katrina came rushing through into their home. Even climbing into their attics could not save them. I was able to rebuild my home, but I'll never be able to get back my friends.
Oh my God, Miss Kathy.
And that deeply affected me. And I dedicate a lot of my work in their memories, Dr. Lewis and Ms. Hernita Maxey.
Yeah, so it's personal for you. I mean, oh my God, it really, I just want to give you a hug. I don't know if you're a hugger, but I just want to give you a hug from the screen. So I mean, kind of to follow up on that, well, first I'm kind of processing a little bit, but I would like to know more about what has happened like in your work since 2005. I know, like, what do you specifically focus on when it comes to fighting for environmental justice? Because it seems like there's a lot that we have to do, and it seems like a lot that we have to work on, but what specifically calls to you?
Absolutely. Let me say that, first of all, during Hurricane Katrina, I remember distinctly riding around, and our government, first and foremost, failed us miserably. The response and the recovery effort were absolutely irresponsible, non-existent. They just absolutely failed us. And then I was able to see the injustices. I was able to see the disproportionate response. I was able to see how relief agencies did not have locations that were accessible to communities who needed these services most. And I remember distinctly thinking that I was reliving Jim Crow all over. you know, in the midst of Hurricane Katrina.
Oh man, because of the government's like response and how it was like unjust?
Absolutely. It was across the board. Government, relief agencies, everybody, it was a total failure. They failed us during Hurricane Katrina. And we spent the first couple of weeks looking after each other. I live a quarter of a mile, about four blocks from the Gulf of Mexico. When I made the conscientious decision that I would live in Mississippi, I would remain in Mississippi, and this would be my home. I knew that the place that I would live in Mississippi would have to be the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I love living near the water. So about 5 years after Hurricane Katrina, I could walk outside my front door that Hurricane Katrina caved in. I could walk, and within 8 minutes, I'm at the Gulf beachfront looking at sludge from the BP oil spill. I was absolutely livid. Absolutely livid at what the BP oil did to the beautiful Mississippi Gulf Coast. So I will often tell people, it was at between surviving Hurricane Katrina and looking at the sludge from BP oil spill, it was at that moment that I took my earrings off. Yes. If you've ever heard Tyler Perry's Don't Make a Black Woman Take Off Her Earrings, that was a moment when I took my earrings off and decided that, you know, we really needed to deal with environmental and climate justice from a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. And if that were not enough, a couple of years after the BP oil spill, the NAACP published a report called Cold-Blooded, Putting Profits Before People. That report examined 378 coal-fired plants around the nation. Well, it comes to find out, among that report, among those plants, was a coal-fired plant that if I walked outside my backyard 4 miles, was this failing coal plant. By this time, I am just absolutely outdone at all of the injustices. And we went right to work hosting town hall meetings because people were just not aware that we were living with these toxins and pollution from this coal plant. They were just completely unaware. And then we had the fossil fuel industry to come and try to counter our advocacy. They told people that the NAACP should stick with civil rights. We did not know what we were doing. They even sent two representatives to talk to us and tell us that they hoped that we were not listening to that Sierra Club because they were just a bunch of rich white people who didn't care anything about jobs. They only cared about birds and trees, which absolutely infuriated me because first of all, they were implying that the NAACP did not have the competency to produce our own research and to make up our own minds. And I had to let them know that I was very well aware of what the CEO of the Southern Company made, and I was aware of what the executive director at the Sierra Club made, and that I would decide which rich white man I wanted to listen to.
Yes! All right, y'all, real quick, here is an ad from one of the organizations anchoring this podcast.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Reverend Michael Malcolm. I am the founder and executive director of the People's Justice Council, as well as executive director of Alabama Interfaith Power and Light. Our mission at the People's Justice Council is to engage and equip communities with tools and access to build power from the grassroots up for change at the policy level. We do this through education and advocacy. Listen, we'd love for you to be a part of the people who are the People's Justice Council.
So, Ms. Kathy, you're still in the Mississippi Gulf area, right?
Absolutely.
So what are some of the changes that you've seen over these years?
Some of the changes, even though we have made some progress, and we have had some victories. So let me even tell you, with this failing coal plant, that the fossil fuel industry took a page out of the Civil Rights Handbook, and they met with local ministers and attempted to convince them that we didn't know what we were doing, that people were going to lose their job, that the city was going to lose its tax base. We had people to come to us and warn us that we would never win, that we were going up against a powerful industry. But I am here today to tell you that of August 2015, the plant no longer burns coal. Never listen to anybody tell you that anybody's power is greater than that of your own.
Amen.
And so we believed in what we were doing. And the ministers who were kind of, you know, they didn't know what to think after they were meeting with us, and then they met with them. And also, they realized that after being told all of these people would lose their jobs, we were being irresponsible. I want you to know, not a single person lost their jobs. Not a single time did anybody go and flip a light switch that they did not have electricity. You know, so they came to realize that we did, in fact, know exactly what we were doing. And they knew that if the plant had been as safe as they claimed it was, that they would have never closed the plant. So that was a huge victory that we won in partnership with the Sierra Club, because the Sierra Club had been at the forefront of that struggle for quite some time. And when the announcement was made, it was a joint effort. It was a coalition effort that led to that, led to the closing of that plant. So that was one big victory. Another thing, I always say I can be the poster child for environmental and climate justice. We had this false climate solution being built in Mississippi, and I'm one of the ratepayers in the ratepayer district of the now infamous failed carbon capture sequestration plant. It was an experiment in Kemper County, Mississippi, that would serve the 23 county service area of Mississippi Power Company, and that's a district where I live. We were against that plant from the beginning because it was experimental. It was in a predominantly minority neighborhood with a high poverty rate, and they went over budget. We opposed it. To give you a bit of a background on that, our former governor at the time was a former lobbyist from the Southern Company. So when he left being a lobbyist and became governor, the first thing that he did was to influence the Mississippi legislature to pass a bill where the ratepayers would have to pay for this facility before it was built. So they were charging us to pay for this experiment, and with their arrogance, they went over budget and they went over time. They went several years over time and several billions of dollars over budget. The plan ended up costing, they stopped at $7.5 billion, and they called it a day, but they wanted us to pay for, you know, a lot more of that plant than what we were willing to pay. The plant now operates as a natural gas, and I hate using that word natural, but it operates as a natural gas. And they were petitioning for us to pay a lot more. We opposed their petition, and again, I'm happy to report that we were successful in that we are only having to pay the cost of what it would have cost for them to build a natural gas plant, which is what that plant is today.
Oh my goodness, congratulations. I mean, y'all shouldn't have to pay for anything, first of all, but like the fact that y'all are able to stick to your guns and stand up to these behemoths, it's really, really inspirational. I mean, you know, they're picking with the wrong crowd. Y'all don't mess with Mississippi, and don't mess with Gulf Coast, Mississippi. Like,
Don't mess with Kathy Eglin, period.
They still haven't learned because we do have net metering that is currently on the docket before the Mississippi Public Service Commission. And we want true net metering. We are asking our Public Service Commission for true net metering. Now, the fossil fuel industry, who have caused insurmountable harm disproportionately to communities of color, are all of a sudden concerned that if we have net metering, that it is going to adversely impact and harm low income and communities of color. I mean, after all of this harm that they have caused, they're now suddenly concerned, quote, wink, wink, about causing harm, when we know that at the end of the day, they're only concerned about their bottom line. So they do not want true net metering. They are calling it a subsidy for the rich at the expense of the poor. So we are interveners on the docket and providing testimony before the Public Service Commission. So we are really, really hoping for some type of victory in net metering and hoping that everyone will have access to clean, renewable source of energy. And ECHO is partnering with Posigen Energy with Solar for All, and that everyone can have solar. It does not matter if you own your home, it does not matter how little or how much your income is, you can have access to solar. And as of April this year, I'm a proud solar owner. I have a solar and I am realizing a tremendous savings in my energy bill.
Oh yeah? That's awesome. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, because I know, like, we mentioned this in an earlier episode of the season, that energy burn-in is a huge issue here, especially for people of color's households, low income households. So solar is actually working for you, it seems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just amazed every time I see my bill, at the savings that I'm realizing. My home is a little over 2,500 square feet, so we do have, a tremendous energy burden that solar has really helped us to alleviate. Just this month alone, again, we saved over $200.
Can you talk about the relationship? Because, first of all, you work for the NAACP, and you're also involved with environmental justice. Can you talk more about the relationship between civil rights and environmental rights and how those connect? Because, listeners, we paused it for a second to talk a little bit about what's going on in Mississippi again. And apparently there's another toxic plant they're trying to put in another African-American community. It's just, you'd think they learned by now that we're watching them. But can you expand on that a little bit?
Okay, well, just to give you a little history and background, of course, the environmental movement was organized before the civil rights movement, before the NAACP. These were two separate movements, unfortunately. At the time, the civil rights movement, we were just fighting for access to some of the places that we had no idea. Some of these places, environmental places, we had no access to them. However, in recent years, the environmental movement have realized that we just need one movement about justice, and that civil and human rights are inherently important and a part of environmental and climate justice. So we continued, and that's why the NAACP got into this. We've had policy on environmental and climate justice dating back to the late 1960s and early 70s. However, we established a program department about 12 years ago because we wanted to look at environmental and climate justice strictly through the lens of human rights and social justice. And as I mentioned in Gulfport, we are currently challenging two plans just due to systemic racist zoning. And we recently won it's kind of a victory. At least we filed a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights through the Department of Transportation under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And they just told us that they have accepted our complaint for a formal investigation. And these developments are in the heart of historical African-American neighborhoods. They will pose flooding risks. They will pose pollution risks. One of the developments is on the site of the contaminated site of a former fertilizer plant. And there are alternatives to these developments. And even today, a news article came out that the plan that we are challenging was the plan that scored the least of the alternatives. These plans are inherently racist. They will cause disproportionate harm to African-American communities. And the fight continues, and we're going to stay and we're going to challenge this systemically.
Well, Ms. Kathy, this kind of leads into our next segment, or the next question. Your strength is inspiring. It really is. Like, your story, the fact that you keep going in this battle after witnessing heartbreaking news and some failures. What keeps you going? This is all an uphill battle of constant issues. What keeps you going and gives you hope to keep fighting?
Oh, well, there are several things. First of all, my past. Looking at people like Dr. King, people like Nelson Mandela, people like Rosa Parks, who just refused to give up, and people like Megger Evers and Vernon Dahmer, who knew the risk involved. And I know growing up, we were exposed to tremendous danger. We were just growing up as children, we were actually followed and spied on by the Sovereignty Commission. We endured bomb threats. Now, I used to wonder if it was just this usefulness and feeling of being invincible, or if we were actually intrepid, just a bit crazy. So I've decided that it's probably a combination of all of the above. There's just nothing. When you grow up on the threat, bomb threat of the KKK, the fossil fuel company, you don't worry about that. You look at what's ahead. But one of the things that I can tell you that inspires me most are the young people. And when I see the interest in the young people, and when I see that young people get it, and when I know that just like I am committed to continue the struggle of those who were ahead of me, I know that long after I'm gone, that there will be someone who will continue this struggle. And that really gives me hope and keeps me going.